Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A major environmental advocacy organization in Massachusetts is getting new leadership. Elizabeth Turnbull Henry is the new president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. She's got a master's in business administration and environmental management from Yale. By the way, when she was at Yale, she lived in a tiny house that she built herself. And for the past 6 years, she's been the head of energy and climate programs at Adidas. But now, as ELM president, she's moving from the world of corporate sustainability to political and regulatory advocacy. Elizabeth Turnbull Henry joins us now in the studio to talk about that transition and her plans for the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's really great to have you. Before we get to sort of the policy stuff, I'd love to actually just get to know you better. I understand that you grew up in West Virginia and you've got some coal connections.
I do, yeah. I grew up in West Virginia in Charleston. And my father, who I love, actually just retired 2 weeks ago from 37 years in the coal industry. And, you know, I love my dad. I think he taught me a lot. And I think he'll make me a better advocate. He and I both believe that energy is the cornerstone to the modern economy, and when it's unreliable, economic development is hard. When it's expensive, it hurts the most vulnerable. And it's generally better to make it here, yeah, right, rather than to import it, particularly from places that don't like us.
Well, so let me ask you, I suppose one of the first questions popping into people's mind then is how does someone, what was your journey from being the daughter of someone who worked in the coal industry to being an advocate for environmental sustainability? How'd you make that path?
Yeah, well, I went to Colby College right up in Maine and had a wonderful experience in an environmental econ class with Tom Teitenberg, who's one of the fathers of environmental econ. And he helped me understand the incredible power of economics to solve some of our environmental problems. Mm-hmm. And also helped me see that this, what has been historically the setup between business v. environmentalists.
Right, an adversarial setup.
Exactly, is pretty outdated. I think businesses have the potential to lead the conversation in many ways. Mm-hmm. They are the employers. And in Massachusetts, for example, I think one of our great stories is the cleanup of the Boston Harbor,
right,
where here you have this explosion of economic development that is unleashed when we steward our waterfront, mm-hmm, and natural resources.
Well, so going back to your childhood and growing up in West Virginia, was the environment ever a dinner table subject? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, I think everyone in the state is, for example, when you fly into the Charleston Jaeger Airport, it's actually built on an old MTR, mountaintop removal mine site. Yeah. And so flying over southern West Virginia, the whole landscape is green and brown and black. And so everyone is living with the sort of the realities of, you know, this is where energy comes from. And America's a great nation in large part because of our history with these fossil fuels. And so I think the idea that there is an easy way to transition away from fossil fuels is false. I don't know if I'm not answering your question very well.
No, you're doing a good job. The reason why I asked is because it has to do with what you said a minute ago about how traditionally, in its most simplistic terms, there's been the trope has been, you know, environmental advocacy versus business, versus corporation, versus industry, right? There's been an adversarial mentality. But it's interesting that your sort of growing up and family experience, along with, you know, the education that you were talking about as an undergrad and a graduate student at Yale, seems to sort of break that adversarial trope down, right? Like it doesn't have, it's more complicated than that, right? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it is more complicated. And I think businesses acting in their enlightened self-interest see that we need clean air and clean water and see that climate change is real and that we need to get ahead of it. At Adidas, for example, I love my time there. I was there for over 6 years. Yeah. I ran our climate or our carbon reduction investment fund. And one of the things that I loved doing was delivering really high rates of return on sensible energy efficiency, renewable energy, other carbon reduction projects. In fact, we delivered a higher rate of return on carbon reduction than we did on our core business of selling sneakers and, and soccer balls. And so I think this story that, oh, it's always going to cost more to take care of the planet, oh, it's always, is actually not always true. In fact, there's remarkable business opportunities. Massachusetts, as you may know, has 100,000 jobs in clean tech. Mm-hmm. And wind technician is the fastest growing job in the country. I mean, I think that there are tremendous opportunities for Massachusetts to lead the nation, and there's tremendous economic opportunities for us to do so.
So tell me a little bit more about what you did while at Adidas, in terms of maybe lessons learned in how to talk to in how advocates, environmental advocates, need to talk to business in order to be, you know, most effective in their advocacy.
Yeah. So one of my instructive experiences in 2014, we were working to do a ground mount solar project in Walpole, Massachusetts. It's using the net metering, virtual net metering program. And, you know, 2.7 megawatts is not certainly utility scale, but it's not small. And it was a great project. It had reasonably strong economics and it leveraged the solar net metering program. So I used a lot of my own, you know, personal and political capital with inside the company, and we got it all the way up the chain, all the way up to our CFO. And he said, all right, let's do it. We've never done anything like this before, but let's do it. And so I turned around back to our developer and said, look, we got this done. And he said, I'm sorry, we've hit the solar net metering cap. We can't do any more solar projects in the state. And it was really heartbreaking and really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And it made me see, I remember lying awake that night thinking, does the government have any idea of how disruptive and destructive it is when you have these really volatile policies to, you know, where incentives are there 1 month and then they're not there the next month. So I see part of this thesis I have that Massachusetts can and should lead the nation in environmental quality and innovative policy is that we need to have a progressive but stable regulatory environment so that businesses can do what they do best, which is look long-term and make investment decisions accordingly.
So that's one of your sort of priorities as you take the helm for the Environmental League of Massachusetts?
So ELM has this great corporate council of 23 corporations from around the state, and raising their voices on issues that they care about is definitely a priority.
Yeah. So I'm curious about how you're, I mean, you're just at the very beginning here.
Right, my first day of the third week. Here we go.
I'll acknowledge that. But the Environmental League of Massachusetts over the past couple of years has really amped up its political advocacy. I mean, for example, it was just a couple of years ago, 2015, I believe, where they set up a super PAC, actually, to become a more effective player in state politics. And also the group also began publishing an annual list of Dirty Dozen lawmakers.
Right.
I mean, so there's some very pointed advocacy that the group has been doing for a couple of years now, which, you know, depending on your perspective, has been effective. I mean, is that something that you would like to see ELM continue?
Oh, definitely. I think the PAC has tremendous potential. We aspire to support environmental candidates when they run and then hold all leaders accountable to the pledges that they made and to make their voting records visible and transparent. That legislative scorecard you mentioned gets a lot of attention. In fact, we were just in a meeting this morning and it came up several times. So it's clearly something that people on Beacon Hill are paying attention to, and I think that's great.
Yeah. So you're taking the place of George Bacharach. He's now officially former president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Great guy. We've had him on the show quite often, but definitely hard charging. He was unafraid to put forth his opinions and criticisms of, you know, a variety of sectors and policymakers in Massachusetts. And I saw he still to this day has some very pointed words about the state's leading industrial or business advocacy group, the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, because George told the State House News Service this. He said, AIM has been the dominant voice on Beacon Hill representing business. And I think it, this is George Bacharach speaking, an extraordinary leader for the 20th century. The problem is we're in the 21st century and they're living in the wrong century. You can't have it both ways. You can't talk about leading the innovation economy if you can't innovate, and they don't. That's what George Bacharach said. Is that the same sort of posture the Environmental League of Massachusetts is going to have under your leadership?
It's a good question. I have a tremendous amount of respect for George, and he's been a wonderful mentor during this transition. You know, we bring different skills and perspectives to the table. I think one thing that George and I share is this idea that that the messenger matters as much as the message. And so unconventional voices that are sort of typically seen as unconventional really can be heard in new and important ways, yeah, particularly at the State House. Yeah. So if you have businesses talking about how much they value meeting their 100% renewable energy goals, which so many of our businesses in Massachusetts have, then, you know, that's heard in a different way than if you just have the sort of standard chorus of environmental advocates saying renewable energy is important.
Very good point. But I also wonder what your answer would be or your response would be to some folks who say, well, if you look at the federal level right now with the EPA, whenever, you know, under Administrator Scott Pruitt, whenever they hear, you know, bringing business to the table in a more meaningful way, they, in their view, that means rolling back of environmental regulations. And, you know, perhaps they may be concerned that could the same thing happen here in Massachusetts if you have business more closely involved or a more significant part of the conversation.
I mean, I guess it depends on the issue. But I think the way in which, you know, our theory of change, the way in which ELM is going to be operating is to be bringing businesses as fellow advocates and also helping us to make the regulations better. So I don't see this as a giant watering down of ELM. I think that they've been the tip of the spear, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah. Just to paraphrase George Bacharach again, an approach for the 21st century,
exactly.
Maybe.
How that, exactly.
Well, Elizabeth Turnbull Henry, she's the new president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to having you back frequently on the show.
Thanks, Magna.
All right, well, let's stick with another environment and sustainability story here for just a second, because there's a new type of ultra-energy efficient construction, and it's beginning to take off in New England. It's called passive housing. And these new homes are so energy efficient that they need no central heating at all. Reporter Fred Bever tells us about some early projects in Boston and in Portland, Maine.
Imported from Germany, residences built to achieve ultra-low energy use. It's been kind of a boutique-y thing here until recently. But now, New England is joining a surge in large-scale passive housing development. The Bayside Anchor, a big, green, somewhat boxy-looking four-story building that overlooks a tidal cove in Portland, Maine, has joined the trend.
Brand new from the ground up. This was a parking lot.
Architect Jesse Thompson says the 45-unit project had to meet a lot of goals. Construction had to be cost-effective enough to get financed by public and affordable housing groups. It needed common areas. It had to be ultra, ultra efficient. And finally, it had to meet the needs of tenants like Peter James, who was one of the first to move in last winter.
I know it has great insulation. I had to shut off my heat. February? It was too hot.
The building does have great insulation. Thompson says the exterior walls are several inches thicker than basic code would require.
Recycled newsprint. It's 10 inches thick, you know, really well done. And there's triple glazed windows. So you can sit next to the window in the middle of winter in a t-shirt and you won't be cold. And that allows us to really radically downsize the heating system.
There isn't a central heating system at all. Instead, each apartment has a small baseboard electric heater with an estimated electricity cost of just $125 a year. It takes more than thick walls to achieve those energy savings. It also takes a near-perfect seal on the building's envelope and a high-tech ventilation system to purge moisture while keeping warm or cool air in, depending on the season. Thompson calls it the building's lungs.
So all the bad air, all the bad smells go out, but the heat stays in. The fancy technical name is a heat recovery ventilator, but they feel like magic to us.
There are other environmentally friendly features, a roof full of solar panels, and underneath the ground floor's polished concrete slab. Instead of a basement crammed with heating systems, big retention tanks allow rainwater to filter slowly into surrounding land, bypassing the city's overworked stormwater system, and offer a cost that's low for Portland's go-go development scene. Thompson says prices for high-efficiency materials and systems are dropping fast. And, he says, public housing agencies are beginning to embrace the long-term savings gain through lower energy and maintenance costs.
Everyone's starting to see how the economics are working. They're giving extra points for meeting these energy goals. So we're going to see a big wave coming in the next 5 years.
It's reached South Boston now.
I don't want to be embarrassing about this, but it's a kind of miracle.
There, on the site of a 19th-century waterfront rum distillery, developer Fred Gordon is renting up the first apartments in what will eventually be a 65-unit passive housing building, very much like the one in Portland. Super tight envelope, high-tech ventilation, and no central heating system. But there's also an important difference. In this case, Gordon isn't relying on government incentives for affordable housing. He's going market rate and plans eventually to sell the units.
It's getting to the point, as an investment decision, increasingly attractive.
In Southie's hot housing market, Gordon's got one advantage. He bought an entire city block there back in 1984 when land was considerably cheaper. But he insists that the distillery project proves any developer can radically reduce a building's carbon output and still make a buck. Gordon says renters and buyers are willing to pay a 10 or 15% premium for passive housing features.
We want to make it so that if a building is not a passive house, then people say, oh, well, that's a real negative.
Officials at the Chicago-based Passive Housing Institute say it's still a big ask to finance market-rate units that won't realize full energy efficiency savings for decades. But momentum for large-scale passive housing really did start gaining last year when the number of buildings the institute certified doubled. And that number is on course to more than double again this year, with projects getting bigger and bigger, including a 350-unit New York City high-rise.
That story from reporter Fred Bever. Back in a moment, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.